So thank you very much for the introduction, and I'm very happy to be here to give this talk on research challenges and feedback computing. So like I said, I was kind of involved in this workshop from the beginning, and this is a topic that has been very close to my heart. And so, when I was asked to give a talk today, I, thought about it and decided that maybe I could give a long kind of view, sort of a little bit of a retrospective of where this field originated and where I think it's going. I'm happy to see that there's a lot of new people here who are attending this workshop for the first time, so you will perhaps gain insight into where, what exactly feedback computing is. So, so I guess we can group the lifetime of feedback computing and this workshop and those types of challenges into kind of three eras, if you will. There are the early challenges, there's a little bit of a more recent research, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the emerging challenges. So how did it all start? It started when people realized that software can be modeled from a control theoretic perspective. So if you have a background in control theory, you have heard the term dynamic systems. Dynamic systems are systems that can be described by difference or differential equations because their characteristics or variables, state variables, change over time. And when we look at performance of software systems, we are essentially dealing with differential equations. And that is because things like, for example, queues that affect performance in a software system are simply integrators of flows. And so you can write it using a difference equation. So these types of realizations were made in different fields some time ago. And hence, the idea that feedback control theory that is typically applied to mechanical systems and so on that are physical systems given by difference equations, the idea that, wow, we can apply that same thing to software because software, like queuing systems, can also be described by difference equations. And so hence, feedback computing was born. And there were a lot of early interesting examples of how to control various aspects of performance. So things like, what do you care about in a computing system? Well, maybe I care about delay. Maybe I care about I/O rate. Maybe I care about utilization. So there are all these controllers that control these parameters, and they're designed using the concepts of feedback control theory, the way one would design a controller, for example, for temperature, or a controller for pressure or something like that in a physical system. So some of the early contributions were, dynamic models of queuing systems. And typically, these models used linear approximations. So linear control theory is very well developed for a long time. It is the low-hanging fruit to apply it. And hence, if I can approximate software by some kind of linear difference equation, I have a wealth of results that I can apply. And I can even automate that. And there were some early results on controlled middleware that essentially bridges the gap between the control engineers and the software scientists that sort of don't know control theory. So this is an example, and this is a very old example, like 15 years old, of how one might model a web server as a bunch of different equations. And here you could see that, it's a bunch of queues, but those queues are kind of like water tank. You put flow in there, and flow comes out, and these water tanks look now like a physical system that you can model using different equations or differential equations, and then you apply control theory. So you have, here's your computing system that is kind of like, think of it as a bunch of queues, and you want to control performance parameters like delay or throughput in those queues. So you measure the actual performance, and you compare it to the desired performance. This is the typical feedback control loop. And then a controller works on the error, sort of the difference between the actual and desired performance, and feeds that into an actuator. The actuator typically is something that reallocates resources among system components in ways that achieve the actual performance that you want. So there's been a lot of work that used that template in different contexts. And then people started realizing that, I can actually start combining different theoretical foundations and some of these control problems. So to give you an example, if I want to control delay in a system, I already have Q queuing theory that predicts what the delay would be in that system, except that that prediction is based on models that are approximate and not entirely correct. However, I can think of that as a feed-forward controller. And then I can use a template that combines feed-forward control, which is sort of the prediction from queuing theory of how resources will affect my delay. And that the prediction might be not perfect, so then I add feedback to it to essentially correct the error. And people showed that, you know, combinations of, say, control theory and queuing theory lead to superior performance. So there were papers like this that show, you know, if I just have a queuing theoretic model and I use that model to do resource allocation in a system, I don't get accurate latency control. If I just have a feedback controller, I also don't get accurate latency control. But if I have a combination of the two, I get very accurate latency control. So that those were some of the earlier contributions. And then people said, well, wow, look, we are really approximating those software systems. We're approximating them by linear difference equations, but they are, in fact, not quite linear. And so what happens is that the parameters of the system change over time, and there are techniques in control theory to deal with that. So there are things like adaptive control that constantly estimate system parameters, sort of the coefficients of those difference equations that we're using. And as these coefficients change because, you know, the system went from one state to another, those will get reflected in a self-tuning controller that sort of adapts to that change. So people used, you know, some of the adaptive control techniques to actually control performance parameters in software systems. Like this is a squid cache, and I think in this particular design, the idea was to control, you know, hit ratio and content. There needed to be an allocation of cache storage space to content classes in order to get some kind of differentiated service to different classes. So that was done with adaptive control. And, you know, results showed that the error becomes smaller and the performance is, control is tighter, and you get basically your quality of service guarantees better. Okay, so those were, you know, some of the initial problems, types of problems that were addressed in this conference some time ago. And perhaps even before the inceptions, maybe this was some of the problems that actually led to the emergence of this conference. So the question is that early work all done, and is there anything you can contribute if you are sort of a first time, you know, getting into the field? And I don't think so. You know, even those early problems, I think, have not been solved completely. So one of the problems that have not been solved is really modeling. You know, if you really think about it, how to model software systems, they're actually very nonlinear, complicated systems, and all that early work was approximations of these systems. And so I think we're still not there yet in terms of really how to model a software system. In particular, linear control theory is kind of an approximation. And so an interesting topic is to understand what are the typical nonlinearities in software control systems, and what are theoretical foundations to deal with these nonlinearities. And there may be some specific nonlinearities that sort of plague software systems. These come from queuing dynamics. You know, queuing theory has certain equations. These equations have certain nonlinear terms. But maybe come from other sources that are kind of fundamental to software design. And then what are these fundamental nonlinearities, how to deal with them, I think is an interesting research topic. Another thing is, what is a control paradigm for these nonlinear systems? And one of the interesting theories that exist for control of nonlinear systems in the control community, and that have existed for a long time, but, you know, now I think reached a level of maturity where it can be applied to many, many systems, is passivity theory. So passivity theory is a theory to deal with nonlinear systems. It's a theory that allows you to build controllers for systems with a certain type of nonlinearity. And shape of this nonlinearity doesn't matter, but what matters is that you have a particular property that you can approximate sort of by saying that the system sort of doesn't generate energy by itself. So as long as you can build a function of state variables that look like an energy function and ensure that the system constantly dissipates that energy, then that system is stable. And if you can add a controller to a system that is unstable, make it stable in the sense that you can prove that it sort of dissipates energy over time and doesn't generate extra energy, then you know that your control will be stable even though the system is nonlinear. And so this is an example of an interesting theory, theoretical foundation for building control techniques for computing systems that are in fact nonlinear. And if you look at computing systems, it turns out that they actually do satisfy these set of equations. So most of the nonlinearities that exist in software, in fact, can fit this model really well. So it seems like passivity theory, for example, is something that has been somewhat underexplored in control of computing systems. And if you have a control background, this seems like a low-hanging fruit to really make impact. That, you know, we're beginning to see some of these results. Like last year, there was a paper that received the best paper award in this conference. It was on passivity theory, and I think we'll see a lot more of these things. Okay. So basically, software dynamics are passive. Applications of passivity theory to software are, I think, very interesting and under-investigated at this time. Okay, that was kind of the basic, the first part, which is sort of on basic modeling of software systems as part of control systems. But more recently, people have started looking, and a lot of this more recent work is attributed to work at HP Labs and sort of its ramifications. But this notion of composability of control loops, that you have a lot of, what happens is that your systems aren't like a small delay control loop or a small throughput control loop or some kind of isolated subsystem. Typically, we are dealing with very large systems of many subsystems that interact. And so while that early work looked at how we tune the individual subsystems and how we make them work in control loops, the question becomes, how do you put those things together? And when you put them together, will they work well? Or will some unexpected things happen that would degrade performance? And there's a lot of evidence that in real life, you can have components that in isolation work really well and are well tuned for what they do. But when you put them together, the combination of these components doesn't work well. And it could be either suboptimal or just outright unstable. And so a lot of work has been dedicated to sort of resolving these conflicts between controllers. Like I said, a lot of this work comes actually from HP Labs. And the problem is getting worse. Software is getting larger, and so the number of components in the system get larger and larger, so the possibilities for conflict, exist and increase. Moreover, when you have a piece of software that is large, you have a larger team of programmers working on it, which means that the purview of each programmer is smaller and smaller. So people who build subsystems, they see smaller and smaller, sort of subset of the whole picture. And moreover, we're trying to make our components smart. So the individual components have ways of self-regulating, self-stabilizing, they sort of respond and adapt to their environment, and that is all fine. You test them, they respond to one environment well, but in combinations that are maybe unexpected, that self-regulating, self-adaptive kind of behavior might be a problem because you don't know how that component will evolve or how its parameter tuning will evolve. So you have a problem with more components that sort of feed off of each other and react to one another, and then the emergent behavior of that large set of components with individually smart features, the emergent behavior of that becomes very hard to predict. And so there's been a lot of work and that, by the way, is an essential quality of feedback. See, if there was no feedback, if I do my thing, you do your thing, we can sit together, I do my thing, you do your thing, and that's that, the interactions are limited. But if we have feedback, then I react to what you do, you react to what I do, you put a lot of these things together, and who knows what the combination is going to do. because everybody is reacting to the other. And so the feedback creates interactions that might create some unexpected behavior that wasn't designed or anticipated at design time. So that's the real problem that we have here. And, you know, this is kind of a way to visualize it, that, you know, you might have three, negative feedback loops in three different subsystems. And a negative feedback loop is sort of a self-regulating loop. Like what I mean by negative feedback, if you are not in sort of the field, if for example the temperature here is too hot, so negative feedback means decrease it, sort of act to in a direction opposite to the stimulus. So that's a self-stabilizing loop. But if you put three of these things together and look at the behavior of the overall system. The behavior of that system, if you kind of merge the nodes that are identical, is like this. And then you see in the middle there is a positive feedback loop. Now, that positive feedback loop is something very dangerous and uncontrolled, because it means that if something bad happens, it gets magnified. It's sort of, there's a positive effect that creates more and more of that same stimulus, as opposed to acts to reduce and kill the stimulus. So positive feedback means instability. So here's an example kind of conceptually of how you can put three subsystems that are individually stable and create something unstable. And indeed, we have seen a lot of these examples in computing systems. So there's been a lot of papers published on, how individually stable components, you put them together, they create unstable systems. And that kind of resulted in a lot of research in the area of, how do you identify these types of problems and how do you resolve them? So one particular research area where we see a lot of these interactions is energy management in data centers. So data centers today consume a significant amount, maybe 2% of the total power, total electricity, total energy rather, in the United States. So it's non-trivial, and it's one of the highest operational costs, maybe after the actual, buying the machines. It's one of the highest operational costs is the energy. And so there's been a lot of work on energy control in data centers, but the question is, how do you do that in an optimal way, and how do you prevent these multiple controllers that may be controlling energy at different levels from conflicting with each other? Okay, so that received a lot of attention, especially that the energy that is being consumed in data centers is actually sum of two things: energy consumed on the computing side and energy consumed on the cooling side, and there are interesting interactions between the two. I'll give you a different type of problem. So this is an anomaly that we observed on one of our small machine rooms in our department. The machine room had maybe 50 servers in it, and it was actually, experimental test bed used by my students primarily to do research on server farms. And while on a regular day, you would see a particular throughput coming from the server farm, but this one particularly warm day, we saw that the throughput went down to zero. Okay, so that's an example problem. Well, what does it have to do with feedback control? It turns out that actually this has to do with feedback. So before I explain why, let me give you one more piece of information about this problem. We thought that, okay, this happening on a warm day, it must have something to do with temperature. Somehow temperature maybe is killing off machines or something like that. So we looked at temperature of the machines. Now this is what the temperature would be on a regular day. And in particular, note that they're all below 60 degrees. 60 degrees was kind of the thermal emergency threshold that we put in there. And so, they're all fine. All the machines have temperature below that emergency threshold. Now, that particular warm day that I talked about when everything went, to zero, well, this is what happened with the temperature reported by different machines. So you can see one machine is above 60 degrees. And that's the only machine that is actually surviving and is operational. And everything else at some point gets turned off. That's when the temperature reporting stops. That's when that curve ends. And it's like, what the heck is going on? The machines that are not in thermal emergency are shutting themselves down, and the machine that is in thermal emergency is the only one that's up. Something is wrong with that picture. And so we, you know, investigated, and it turned out that, it was an interesting interaction between the thermal management policy, the energy aware load balancer, and the machine on-off policy. Okay, it created an unstable feedback loop. Now, what was the loop? There are a bunch of machines balancing load among them. And the load balancer wants to utilize all the machines, you know, keep them at high utilization. When one of those machines overheated, it went into this emergency mode where it would essentially sleep for a long period of time. And so its utilization would never be high. And then the load balancer, which was actually unaware of the, you know, emergency mode, would try to increase that machine's utilization by pushing more load to it. And so it created that futile control loop where you shift more and more load to that machine trying to make its utilization go back up to the set point, but it never goes back up to the set point because it's in emergency mode and it's doing, you know, duty cycling to keep its utilization down. And so the load balancer kept shifting more and more load until it drained the load from the rest of the farms, stuck it all in the one machine, and the rest of the farm found nothing to do, so it shut down. So that was, you know, an example of how a feedback control loop that is trying to keep utilization constant went essentially haywire and created this shutdown scenario. So what is the problem there? Well, the problem there was that whoever designed the feedback loop for the load balancer didn't take into account the thermal emergency modes. So as you basically put systems together from multiple components, you'll have higher and higher chances of encountering cases where somebody who designed one component didn't anticipate the existence of another component, and then those two created a clash and created a bad interaction. So there's been a lot of work that sort of was trying to identify these types of interactions when they happen, because they happen because of feedback, and resolve them. So there's work on the diagnostic area, you know, why this happened, what kind of feedback loops were involved, how to resolve them. There was also work on sort of how to design systems from scratch to not have those types of interactions, and how to holistically, you know, a lot of that work had to do with holistic optimization. You know, I need to really make sure that I don't design components individually and then stick them together. No, that would be bad. Rather, I design my whole system from scratch at one piece and then holistically optimize the whole thing. So obviously, when you can do that, that's great. Sometimes you don't have all the components at the same time, so you can't do that. So then you have to do something else, including, you know, diagnostics. Bad things will happen, and then you have to diagnose why they did. Okay, so there's been a lot of work on these composability solutions. I'll call them composability solutions, which is sort of, you know, how to avoid some bad interactions. You know, if you detect bad interactions, how to design the systems to avoid them. How to design, you know, holistic solutions that sort of jointly optimize performance. That received a lot of interest. And then how to troubleshoot unexpected interactions when they happen. So in my opinion, this is a very important area in feedback computing. It received a lot of attention. And I don't think, you know, it's been solved. I think as systems grow and as, you know, the opportunities for interactions increase and become harder to sort of analyze all holistically in advance, we'll see more and more performance problems and stability problems that arise because of these interactions, and we'll have, you know, need to have better and better tools that deal with them. So let me give you a couple of examples of things that people have already done. So this again is work with HP Labs actually. This is a problem where there was a virtual machine kind of CPU allocation controller, and it tries to allocate, you know, virtual, you know, CPU cycles to different virtual machines to reach a particular delay, latency kind of threshold for the different virtual machines. And you could see that it's not really doing a good job. So, this is the response time threshold for one machine, and that's the response time, sort of the desired response time for the other machine. And then you could see the actual response time is all over the place. So there's some interaction with something else that's going on here that needs to be identified. And when, you know, the researchers doing that looked at it more carefully, they realized that, it's the memory. that the memory wasn't enough for both virtual machines, and when the memory is not sufficient for a particular virtual machine, it would start doing a lot of paging activity, and that would degrade performance. So they said, well, what we really need here is then two controllers, one for the CPU allocation, but one for memory allocation. And the goal of the memory allocation controller is to make sure you avoid the bad region where you create that bad interaction. So you avoid the region where you see excessive paging activity. And you know, that was implemented. And then you could see, wow, you know, the performance improved quite a bit. So this blue line here is the latency achieved by the joint controller, which controls both CPU and memory, compared to the black line, which controls only the CPU. And you could see that, well, the joint does a much better job because it sort of puts its finger on the source of the problem and avoids the bad interaction between, you know, memory utilization and CPU utilization. So that's you know, an example of sort of work that tries to create feedback control policies that avoid regions where systems exhibit bad behaviors or bad interactions. Let me maybe skip this example. Another example that was actually published in a paper from CMU recently looks at data centers and shows that, well, you have a computing system that you can optimize by doing load allocation among the machines. You have a cooling system that you can optimize by setting the temperature, sort of desired temperature set points for the different cooling components in the machine room. And you can do that separately, or you can do that jointly. And if you do that separately, you will actually have not as good of performance as if you do that jointly. So here the performance metric was total energy consumed, and the idea was how to minimize it. So if you minimize it in each subsystem separately, you'll, you know, be okay. But if you think of it as a joint single optimization problem like this, with both you know, here you had an optimization problem for energy of you know, computing, and an optimization problem for energy of cooling separately. If you actually put it together, you'll have one combined energy optimization problem subject to the combined set of constraints, and they showed that the combined energy optimization problem results in a much better sort of you know, lower energy consumption than if you optimize things separately. And, you know, there's been other results. So this is results actually from our group, and they essentially show the same thing. I'll skip to the important slide, which is this. So here, a lot of different energy control policies were compared, and the optimal here was the holistic optimization. So if you think of all the cooling and computing as, you know, one big subsystem, and you optimize jointly all the parameters, you get better performance. So this again kind of suggests that the sort of divide and conquer approach doesn't really work here, because if you divide the problem and then optimize separately, it sort of doesn't lead to as good of a result as if you consider it holistically. Now, this is a problem, because as systems grow, ultimately the holistic approach is going to break. You can't know and see everything, you know, about the system. So how do we build efficient systems without having to do that holistic optimization? So I think that's an interesting research problem that, you know, still needs more work. We have identified that, yes, if you holistically optimize everything, it's going to be better. But is that practical? Well, maybe for sort of a mid-scale system, but as systems grow, ultimately it's not going to be practical. So something else has to be done. Okay. Another approach that kind of falls into the category of understanding interactions between subsystems and understanding how these interactions affect behavior is where you have unexpected interactions happening, leaving you with some performance problems, and then you have to troubleshoot these performance problems. So that's another direction of research. Here, you sort of assume that whoever did the design probably didn't use that holistic approach, or they missed something, you know, some subsystem that interacts and messes up the others. And so unexpected things happened at runtime. Now you have to figure out why. And there were several techniques used in diagnostics. Some of them are based on machine learning, kind of data mining types of approaches. Here I'm going to describe a very simple one that is based on simply looking at correlations between key variables in your system. And that approach basically says that, look, if you have a watch and there's lots of moving components, they move, you know, all at speeds that are very precisely correlated to one another. But if something breaks, then you'll see a moving part in another part that's sort of not moving. And so basically the correlation breaks. And if you figure out where the correlation broke, you can figure out what went wrong. And so in software systems, you kind of apply that wisdom that says, well, you have a lot of variables that affect one another, and so there are sort of normal correlations that you would expect between those variables. If those correlations somehow broke between some of the variables, then something went wrong, and you have to look at why in that, you know, at those particular variables and why the correlation between them broke. And a lot of the time in software, when that happens, then if you have any type of feedback control loops, they will probably now be either open loop or unstable, because you know the feedback control loops kind of assume a particular model. When correlations change, it means that your model changed, and so those controllers are probably now not working right. So there were examples of papers that sort of built tools that try to automate that type of diagnostics. They look at key variables, they learn sort of how the variables affect each other, and they periodically recalculate whether these correlations still hold. And then if something changes, like a particular correlation that was a negative correlation became positive, then that's a big problem. So it flags that problem, and it opens that loop, or does some kind of recovery action. So let me give you one example of that. It was applied to a server utilization control problem, where the utilization controller would sort of invite more requests to come to the server if the server is underloaded. And when it's overloaded, it starts to push back on the request rate. It's perfectly normal, you know, if you're underloaded, give me more requests. If I'm, you know, overloaded, hold back. That's perfectly normal. It makes the very natural assumption that the utilization and the request rate are sort of positively correlated. You increase the utilization or increase the request rate, you increase the utilization. Well, that turns out to be not always true. Sometimes in Linux, you can increase the request rate and your utilization will go down. And the reason is, in Linux, there is something called the anti-receive live lock mechanism. The way it works is when you get a lot of requests off the network, it changes from network sort of driven I/O, from interrupt-driven I/O, to polling-based I/O. So the sort of the low-level handler that dequeues packets off the network becomes not interrupt-driven, but rather polling, it polls. And it polls at a lower rate, so the utilization will go down. So basically, when you have a huge overload coming from the network, it's kind of like a denial of service attack. To combat it, it'll start using polling-based I/O, and so the amount of the machine used to receive packets off the network, you know, that utilization becomes a lot lower, and that's the whole purpose from that mechanism. It's sort of anti-receive live lock. But you know, our controller doesn't know, so it just sees that wow, you know, suddenly the utilization dropped. I must invite more requests. But what it doesn't know is the reason it dropped is because we received a huge amount of requests off the network, completely overloaded everything. You know, that interrupt-driven I/O just completely overloaded things. And so we switched to polling-based I/O. And now the utilization dropped, but I still have a lot of requests coming in. So I actually have to reduce the number of requests, not increase the number of requests. So this is an example where the natural correlation between two variables broke. And as a result, the control action did the wrong thing. It actually invited more requests to a server that's already overloaded. So here, the automatic diagnosis can catch that, because if it looks at sort of the correlation between request rate and utilization, when the machine switches to point based I/O, that correlation dips and becomes negative. It changes sign, and that is kind of a hint that the assumptions underlying that admission control loop are no longer working. Something happened that invalidates them. We need to first of all open that loop so that it doesn't make things worse, and then figure out what's going on. So this is an example where adding a mechanism that responds to these changes in correlation would actually saves the system from getting into this unstable mode where overload creates more overload because the admission controller is doing exactly the wrong thing now. Okay. So that's kind of like the second part of my talk about a problem that I think personally is of huge importance, and it's hugely entrenched in the concept of feedback, and that is feedback creates interactions between components, and those interactions, when the number of components grow, can create problems. So feedback by design, you're not going to create problems, but the problem appears when some components have unintended interactions that the designers didn't actually think of. And it's that feedback that's going to create problems with large systems. So are we done? Did we resolve all that? I don't think so. I think what we're missing is, like I said, current solutions say, well, do it holistically. Holistically look at the whole system. But that's not particularly scalable, and it's not particularly feasible in many systems to really understand everything in order to design a system that works. So what we need is something compositional, where you build systems where your performance of the composite can be predicted from performance of the components, so that well-behaved components are guaranteed to create well-behaved systems. And how to build systems with this type of compositional property is not clear. Today, systems aren't like that. Today, you put well-behaved components together, and you get very poorly behaved systems sometimes. And so what constraints do you need to impose on component composition that would ensure that when you compose components subject to these new constraints, well-behaved components always give you well-behaved systems? So to go back to something I said earlier, passivity theory offers a set of composition rules that say if you have passive components, you put them together subject to these rules, you still have a passive system. And so whatever stability properties were true of the components, they would still be true of the whole system. So that gives you a platform, a way to offer, say, compositional stability guarantees. But we need more of that. We need things like that that will tell you, okay, as long as I compose subject to these rules or meeting these types of constraints, then I get well-behaved systems. So I think this notion of compositional performance guarantees compositional properties of large systems is very important, and it's extremely important in systems where there's lots of feedback, because like I said, feedback is what creates interactions, and interactions is what creating the problems, the non-compositional problems. All right, so let me maybe mention one or two kind of new challenges that haven't quite been addressed. But they arise because of new applications that we are starting to look at more deeply. So if you look at what is today's applications of feedback computing? And I think the application, this is a great time to work on feedback computing, because the applications have grown, have fast surpassed these first original kind of, server-based, systems. Now we have a lot more exciting things. So, for example, healthcare. There's a tremendous effort kind of going towards empowering the individuals to manage their own health. And what that means is, I'll have a lot of sensors that sort of manage my health, but I'm not a health professional, so there has to be some kind of feedback loop closed with my health provider and caregiver and so on. And there are certain safety properties that have to be, ensured in this type of, feedback loop. So those devices shouldn't hurt me. I shouldn't, even if I misuse them, I shouldn't hurt myself, and things like that. And so how do you ensure properties of systems like that that have feedback at multiple timescales from timescales inside my body? You know, the system is affecting me somehow. Maybe I'm a diabetic and this helps me manage my sugar, to kind of feedback from me to health providers and external intelligence. So in general, these types of home care systems and their safety and integration is one application. Another application is energy. So energy is becoming more and more important, and the prices of energy are fluctuating, but tend to be on an upward trajectory. And so today we do a very poor job of controlling energy, and especially in things like buildings. So in the U.S., about 40% of total energy is spent on buildings, and that energy, a lot of it is wasted. And so, if you want to find a place where there's a good bang for the buck in terms of hugely reducing national energy consumption, it's buildings. So how do we intelligently control energy in buildings? That is an interesting challenge, and it's not just putting a thermostat. It's also understanding the usage patterns of these things, understanding doing some kind of predictive control. I think this is a very interesting topic. The other, still speaking of energy, perhaps and time. The other big pain that we deal with is traffic. Again, gas is expensive, and being in traffic jams like this is not particularly pleasant. And so the transportation system, it's a very large system. There are feedback control knobs to it, because I can tell drivers, avoid this route, go this other route. They'll probably not listen, but some of them might. And so it is an interesting kind of feedback control challenge. And the question is, can I manage transportations in ways that optimize, for example, commute time, or optimize my gas bill? I think that's an interesting feedback problem. Sustainability in general, I guess I talked about energy, so sustainability. This is actually in Sweden, glacier in 28. This is that glacier, what it looks like today. So it changed quite a little bit from before, maybe because of global warming. But in general, sustainability is a tough problem, and we need to have solutions to manage the problem. Now, if we move energy sources from today's sort of brown energy, like fossil fuel, to things like this, we have significant control problems, because we have unpredictable energy supply that needs to be matched with the demand. And so rather than today, where the supply has to follow demand. I turn on the light, there better be enough electricity to do that. Tomorrow, the demand will have to follow the supply, because the supply is going to be green, unpredictable, renewable energy. And, things like that consume energy will have to somehow morph their total energy consumption to match the supply, which is an interesting problem. Disaster response. I think also, how do you react to destruction? This is, by the way, a picture of the tsunami that hit Japan in 2011. So immediately you get a lot of destruction, and you have to respond to it, which is some sort of feedback. And so you have to operate that feedback in an optimal fashion to save as much as possible with the little resources that you have. And so how do you solve that type of feedback problem? So that's an interesting problem. One thing common about all of these problems is that they are cyber-physical. They include a big physical system as part of the problem, whether it's a transportation system or green energy farms or a disaster or a building. But they also have increasingly more reliance on some kind of a cyber component. For example, in the disaster recovery, there will be a lot of reports coming in, and some of them are bogus and rumors, and some of them are true. And so you might need a significant, almost like a data mining component, to just understand what happened before you even react to it. So there's a significant cyber kind of piece, a significant computing piece inserted in that system that gives you an important part of the functionality of that system. And so your feedback loop is not just closed around the physical system, it's also closed around an information system. And how do you manage a loop that is closed around both a physical system and an information system, like perhaps some kind of a data mining algorithm that's trying to suppress rumors from patterns of received information? The other thing is that if you look at one thing common in those systems is people. People are part of those systems. People in medical applications, people in, you know, buildings, people who drive cars, people who consume energy, people who are affected by disaster. And so a lot of the systems are with human in the loop. People play an important part of the system. And so when we talk about future of feedback computing, it's feedback computing in social context, in people context. How do we account for the role of the person in the loop? I think that will be a very interesting kind of future problem. One opinion is that, you know, cyber-physical feedback computing systems kind of live in human spaces, and so research must address the human in the loop. Okay, so since we are at 10, I'll skip a few slides that sort of describe the role of humans in the loop. Maybe conclude or go closer to the conclusions that basically say, look, what are the challenges that what are the challenges and kind of opportunities that are emerging? When people are involved, you also will have new modalities of control, new performance metrics that you want to control. Some of these performance metrics are things like quality of information. So if you talk about a disaster response system, and a disaster happened, and there are all kinds of rumors of what really happened and what didn't happen, and we need to quickly respond. If your information is bad, you're going to respond to the wrong thing. It's like having a faulty sensor and a feedback loop around it. So in typical control loops, we sort of really don't worry about bad sensors. We have a sensor model, a noise model, and that's about it. But when you talk about something like disaster recovery, you know, you collect a lot of information. It's contradictory. It's noisy. Some of it is incorrect. Some of it is exaggerated. Some of it just plain wrong. And you have to react based on that. So how to perhaps estimate the true state of the physical world from these very noisy measurements? That's like an estimation theoretic problem. But it needs a formal model. You know, how do you model the information that you get and the relations, like a rumor, for example? What's a rumor? Well, it's somebody measured something and others repeated it. So it's kind of correlated inputs, correlated errors, perhaps. So how do you model the sensor before you can even react to it? And we need to kind of understand parameters of quality of information, and then you need to optimize these parameters as part of your feedback control loop. So that's an interesting challenge. You know, how do you control or optimize quality of information in these types of information-centric systems? It also leads to this challenge of, well, how do you close the loop around more complex sensors? So if I'm measuring something simple, that's fine. But if I'm measuring a lot of different things and then I have complex, you know, classifiers or maybe even data mining algorithms that I try to understand what happened, that's a very complex sensor. How do you model that sensor in your feedback control loop? What else do we have other than feedback control theory? So feedback control theory is very good at what it does. Some of these other applications where there is feedback, there is response to things that happened, other theoretical foundations that we should borrow from, you know, other communities besides, you know, the control community. You know, what are other opportunities that we can identify that would give us sort of the analytics, the underlying fundamental theoretical foundations based on which we can build systems with interactions that are safe and that don't break and that perform to specifications. So these are some of the, you know, other challenges. So I guess to conclude, I think, you know, in this community, in our feedback computing, we've done significant steps. There's a lot more to be done. One of the interesting challenges is humans in the loop, and actually we're going to see a talk about humans in the loop in the challenge papers later today. These people can have different roles. They can be a disturbance. Like we are, from a control theoretical perspective, in this room we are kind of a disturbance because, you know, the temperature controller would have been fine without us, but now we're in, we kind of disturb the temperature. So that's one way we affect systems. But we can sometimes be the operators. So in the traffic control example, we are the operators. We operate our vehicles. We make independent decisions. We cannot be told, drive this way or else. If I want to drive the other way, unless there's a law against it, I can drive the other way. So we are operators that don't quite follow the control policy. And so how to design controllers that deal with these types of operators is interesting. Or we could be sensors. Like I said, in the disaster response scenario, we often act as the sensors. We deliver information on what has happened. You know, a tsunami did this and this and this and this. We are in those locations. We report that damage. So we act as the sensors. But we're very unreliable sensors. And we are sensors that gossip. Because I can invent something or I thought something happened that didn't really happen. I tell my friends. Now my friends think it happened. Now they tell their friends. And before you know it, 1,000 people are telling you something, and it's wrong. So that's what type of sensors we are. How do we deal with this type of, you know, imperfect sensor? How do we model that sensor? How do we incorporate that sensor model in a feedback control loop? So that's interesting. And then, you know, once we solve these problems, we have a lot of new applications where we can apply feedback with these new sensors, new actuators, and new performance metrics, where we can interface with data mining research, we can, you know, machine learning, we can look at quality of information issues, we can look at data to decision pipelines, which actually are feedback control systems. So if you look at some of the recent directions in military funding in the United States, one of the big buzzwords is data to decision. You know, you have a kind of a critical scenario, you have lots of data, it's typically poor quality data, contradictory from bad sources, and you want to make a decision. Well, that's feedback, because you're acting on sensors, you're acting on data, data is your measurements, and your decision is kind of your feedback. So how do you optimize that to make better decisions? And there are still unresolved challenges that go back to the early days of feedback computing, including how do we build nonlinear software models? Even for something as simple as, you know, a bunch of servers, it's still nonlinear. How do you build a good model? And then how do you get composability? So I gave in this talk examples of how things don't compose very well, and, you know, combinations of policies that are individually reasonable because they didn't know about each other's existence give you something unreasonable. So how do we solve these types of composability problems? So in short, I think we have a good mix of old and new challenges that have not been resolved. And, you know, I look forward to many more incarnations of feedback computing and see how these things pan out. So thank you all very much.
I have a few questions and we'll go to coffee break. Thank you for your overview, and I was really sensitive to the composability notion, because indeed, even in the broader autonomic computing context, you know, Jeff Kepert is saying that combining autonomic loops is hard and is not much worked out, I would say.
Yeah.
So in control either. And so I have two questions, actually. One is about the, I would say, continuous control approach, and I would like to ask continuous control people, is there some background in, you know, very big chemical factories or things like that? Having hierarchical control in continuous control is something which exists also in the physical world. Maybe it would be important in the computing world. And the other question is about when you go composability and hierarchy, you're losing you're losing information somewhere. You have to use abstract models. And would that be, well, The way I approach it is to use a discrete control, where you would go in switching on and off or between modes of such controllers. The second question is that a direction which you would be interested in?
Well, so first, there are experts in control that can answer the question better than me. But let me try to offer one thing. So in terms of hierarchical control, I think there's been a couple of papers on precisely that in literature already. And in some sense, hierarchical control works if there's a single sort of management structure that is overseeing the whole system. It probably has limitations if you have more of kind of autonomous agents interacting together, like maybe a transportation system or something like that, or even systems that are just you get different parts from different vendors and they don't follow the same hierarchy. But yes, I think we need a combination of sort of architectural principles like hierarchy or something else, and guidelines on the designs of the individual components that can fit into that architecture. And then for the discrete part, I think, probably formal techniques can be borrowed to reason about the behavior of the system. But I think some of that formal reasoning, formal methods and verification and so on, might not work if I have systems where I don't have access to part of the code, or I don't have, I can't, part of the components are third-party components. I don't have their models. So again, maybe we need to combine some of these formal techniques with some architectural techniques that would say, I have a couple of key components, and those are verified, and as long as those are correct, the behavior is going to be safe. But then I have all these other components that are unverified, but they are guaranteed not to do damage, because if they did, my verified component will take over or something like that.
It's more about control than about verification, actually. And then indeed you will have to equip the individual controllers which you want to compose. They could have to be equipped with some local control, which you then would use to control their interactions. But I can tell you about that.
Okay.
Two things. What extent would you say the solution to problems with interaction within feedback components is more feedback, more controls, and basically coupling the systems with other control loops? To what degree is it, would you say that's a solution, or is it that's causing more problems? The other thing is, you didn't mention security at all.
Yes, I think actually, security I should have added, and that's a good, that's a good point. Especially as things become more networked and you can access a lot more physical systems, for example, remotely, you need cyber physical security, if you will. Going back to your first question, if I understood it correctly, some of the interactions are truly sort of explained by control theory. So basically, in some cases, you really are closing kind of a positive feedback control loop that you can analyze by writing equations and showing that, yes, this is actually unstable. And if I, for example, added this part to it, it becomes stable again. So part of it can be is kind of fall squarely in control theory, but then other parts you need other models for them, so they don't have say the dynamics that the control theory focuses on, and maybe some data mining algorithm will be fine, uncovering some strange interaction that is sort of not inherently a dynamic system stability problem.
When I say it was feedback
forcing. Oh, I see.
That's actually important in my research.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a very good direction.
I guess my question is concerning about control generally the parametric in this sense. But in these sub-physical systems or even software systems, a lot of the changes or noise is rather a reconfiguration of that. In the sense, it's a major change to the system. How do you see that kind of a change or the interaction in that reconfigurational versus parametric, and how the control could come into play in that context?
Yeah, so if you have updates to what the system actually does, I think, you know, there needs to be something that sort of guarantees. So in a different community, you know, in real-time systems, there's been a lot of work on, for example, things called mode changes. So in that community, they worry about latency, and they want to make sure that latencies, they don't, you know, go above a deadline. And so there's been a lot of work on these mode changes to ensure that when I replace a whole bunch of components by a whole bunch of other ones, yes, before the transition, maybe things are guaranteed to meet performance requirements. After the transitions are guaranteed, but during the transition, how is that guaranteed? And so I think we need techniques like that that sort of deal with the mode change itself and in what order should it be applied so that it doesn't disrupt things while it's being applied.
How do you deal with non-numeric inputs, categorical types, or labeled inputs where there's no sense or even way to assign a number to them, whether it's linear or non-linear? Do you have any thoughts about how to address systems with those other kinds of inputs?
So could you give me a context, just like an example,
yes,
of something you think of?
How do I choose the I/O scheduler in Linux as for them? How do I choose a compression algorithm or technique with all of its internal parameters that are really very different, you know, internal algorithms, in order to, say, control the rate at which I might compress data based on, you know, compression ratios or inputs or data, because, you know, different inputs will compress it. So we were trying to figure out these kind of problems.
Yeah, I mean, if you know something about the label, the more you know about the label, the better. So if you're talking about, for example, choosing one of multiple algorithms and you can characterize this algorithm by certain features, then you can show that, you know, now you have feature in a comparable kind of space, and then this algorithm is described by these features, this algorithm is described by those features, and you sort of look at which features are most compatible with what you are trying to achieve. But if you really have just labels and you don't absolutely know anything about what these labels are, you know, algorithm X, black box, it's hard, I think. So I guess I don't really have an answer to that part of the problem.
Okay. Thanks again for Tarek for giving us a wonderful keynote. It's a very good start.
Thank you very much for inviting me.